Ecclesiastes 2:12-2:26. The third talk in a series on Ecclesiastes was presented by Wes Hurd on February 9, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're back in Ecclesiastes. Once again, I have to confess that the time I have spent this week pondering, thinking, trying to figure out what this book is saying has been incredibly personally profound. I mean, that's pretty much the case anytime you take time to study the content of the scriptures and really try to understand what's going on, because it penetrates to the core of who we are and what we are as creatures. What does it mean to be human? That is a very definite vision of what that means. As well, this book has a very definite vision of what this life offers and indeed what it does not offer. I was thinking on the way over this morning that a thought that I had carried the first time I taught this a couple of years ago on just one session on Tuesday nights, that there's hardly a book or a topic or a subject raised by a book of the Bible or for any source that would raise these issues in the way that this book raises them that would be more difficult for this generation, for our time in history, for this culture to hear, to really listen to, and to buy. As Bob said, it's not really ultimately a dark book in the sense of its melancholy sort of tone and all that I've spoken of the last 2 weeks. Ultimately, it's the truth. If you buy it, it's the truth. And if it is the truth, then it's enlightening, and it leads us toward, if we're open to it, it leads us toward life, toward really understanding it and what God is doing and how he's going about it. But at the same time, it is a message that is clear-eyed and straight ahead and very direct about what this world has to offer and what it does not have to offer. So this morning, what I'd like to do, I'm actually going to have to change my goals. From what I mentioned last week, my intention was to go through quickly through chapter 2 and get into chapter 3 and then try to maybe even jump a little bit further into the book and sort of tease a couple of themes out in the book. But there's just too much here to be looked at, too much to ponder, too much to think about. So I'll try to perhaps pick up some of this later in the year when I have another opportunity to do this. Just a quick review. The book of Ecclesiastes is a book of wisdom written by Koheleth, the Jewish word for the one who stands before the assembly. It comes from the root word assembly. So it's the one who stands before the assembly, or the preacher, as he is called in the book. Actually, that's his self-title. This is very, very, and very quite possibly, this is Solomon, King David's son, the richest, wealthiest, most powerful king that ever lived, at the height of time in Israel when it was a virtual golden era. They were on peace all the way around on all sides. They were positioned in a place and a time when trade routes and opportunities for entrepreneurial business and the building of the kingdom physically, materially, were never better. So Solomon was given the throne at a time when Israel had all the potential to become what indeed it did become in terms of material wealth, power, glory under Solomon. And he's writing this book as he looks back on his life. And I think it's really important to remember that, that the genre, the kind of writing that this is a man reflecting on life and writing in a wisdom, a sort of proverbial and poetic way, reflecting on his life and how he sees it at the end of his life. And the general drift and tone of the book can be captured by just reading a few verses. I can reflect on these for just a moment as we sort of warm up to where we're going today. The first words in the book, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And in these few words, he gives us the theme or thesis of the book. Namely, that everything in this world, everything that we experience in the human experience, is qualified. Qualified in such a way that it will not fulfill us, ultimately. Not in the way that we yearn to be fulfilled. He goes on to say, in verse 3, what advantage or what profit, that's the language that sort of sets a tone for the book, what advantage or profit does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? He's looking at sort of through the lenses of a man who has built a kingdom, who's built an empire, who is wealthy beyond imagination, who has power beyond imagination, who has at his resources the pleasures, both sensual and aesthetic, that no man could rival at this time in history, and probably at any time. And he says, in all that, what advantage to me? Ultimately, what profit is there? And he says, then he brackets it. I was talking with Jack about this a little bit this week, and I think he's right. He suggested that when he uses the term under the sun, which I talked a little bit about last week, that there's a very real sense in which that's a clue to what his intentions are with this entire book. Namely, he's looking back and he's wanting to write something that is a proverbial goad to teach us and to drive us in a particular direction towards the truth, toward wisdom. And he brackets his purposes by saying, what I'm looking at here is all the activities, achievements, and glory of human existence. Everything that is possible for a human being to attain, to possess, to enjoy, to have, I'm going to look at that. That's what he means by under the sun. So he's not talking about a whole lot of stuff that, for example, his father, King David, talked about in the Psalms, where we see a very different kind of tone of a worshiping, humble, strong love, emotional love for God, a relational kind of relationship to God. The focus that Solomon is giving us here is purposeful. That is, he has a particular bracket that he wants to examine, a certain amount of a way of looking at something, a particular angle. And I think his personality and his life, his experiences have colored how he's looking at this stuff at the end of his life. So he says in verse, when he gets down, I'm going to skip over some things here. He goes through the first few verses there talking about looking at nature and creation and seeing certain patterns, cyclical patterns, and how there's sort of a wearying cycle and repetitive nature to life. You get this, then you get that, and then it just never gets any better. That kind of tone to the whole thing. And he draws those pictures from analogies in nature. Then he gets to verse 12 and he says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. Again, just to review, he's He is setting out, as he looks back and he's telling his story, he's casting this in a way that where he sees that what he was doing and what he was about was to actually test life. He was going to take on the task that he now sees God has given to all his creatures, all men and women, all humankind. Namely, to live existence, to experience it, and to figure it out, and to seek and explore and see what is worth anything in this life. What can be seen as truly valuable in this life? So he sort of entitles that job or that assignment as a task that God has given to everyone. And that's his task. He's taking it on. So he sets out to do that. And then we went last week into how he began to use his wisdom, and to examine his wisdom, in a sense, as a tool to see, what does my wisdom have to offer me? What can I do with it? And he stretched out his wisdom into a reach to try to explain his experience, to understand, to penetrate reality and experience and to draw from it what was essentially true. Through the masks, through the surface, to the core of what was the real nature of our experience and reality in this world. And then he also says, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to pursue fun. And he calls it madness and foolishness, the flip side of wisdom and true knowledge and understanding is to just let loose, have fun, go with the flow, party till the lights go out. And so in chapter 2, he begins by saying, I'm going to test life. I'm going to test myself and my experience in life from the standpoint of what does pleasure have to give. And he outlines all the way through this down to chapter, we got down through 11, I think. But he basically talks about how he built things, he planted things, he had thousands of animals and horses, and he had male and female slaves, and he had gold and silver. I mentioned last week that I did a little homespun calculation and figured out that according to First Chronicles, his annual take just gold was around 20 tons of gold a year. That's a bunch. So he on the one hand, he pursues with his mind and wisdom, and he wants to understand exactly what's going on and what's really happening. Then he pursues pleasure, and he stimulates his body with wine and drink and women and song, and he says he has concubines. He has all the pleasures that are available to a man like him. And he tries it all. And he says in verse 10, let's kind of pick it up right there this morning, of chapter 2. And all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold from my heart any pleasure. For my heart was pleased because of all my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all the my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted. And behold, all was vanity and striving after wind. And there was no profit under the sun. Again, his sort of classic response to testing the opportunities that present themselves in his life. So he says in verse 10, I did not withhold from my heart any pleasure. I pursued all these things. He's sort of reflecting quickly on the reward of what he's just talked about in that chapter, the parks and the buildings and the wealth and the sensuality and the experience, the hedonistic experience that he did not withhold from himself. And he says, and this was my reward for all my labor. It's as if it seems to me at that point that he's basically saying, you know, I took a quick look at that and I kind of looked at it and I said, wow, that's okay. You know, I got something from that. That, you know, it was sort of a quick reflection. He just sort of glance back at it quickly while he's almost still finishing it up, and he looks at it and he says, yeah, that's, I got something from that. That's, I got, this was my reward for my labor. I worked hard and I got something. Then in verse 11, he says, thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted. And behold, he says, now let me sum this. He says, all of this was vanity after all, and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. This seems to be contradictory. And I think if we get this straightened out, then it gives us a clue to the whole drift of the book. On the one hand, he says, he seems to allude to the fact that he gets a reward from his labor in verse 10. And then he turns around in verse 11 and says, you know, all my labor ended up being futile. So what do you make? How do you make sense out of that? The only way I can at this point is to think that he's thinking here about two frames of reference. There is a certain sense in which our labor in this world, our work, our achievement, the things that we can get out of this world, there is a certain satisfaction in them. And I think the first reflection in verse 10 is that quick assessment, that first satisfaction, that first sort of assessment of, yeah, that was okay. And then the language of verse 11 seems to give us a different sort of tone. He says, thus I considered, and he uses a word there that he doesn't use in verse 10, the word considered. It connotes the idea of really looking at it. The first glance was sort of that quick assessment. The second glance wasn't just a glance. It was turning and deeply and critically considering with discernment, asking the question, after all, is it really of substance? In other words, there's sort of an emphatic conclusion and summary to where he's been with both his mind and wisdom on the one hand and perceptive knowledge on the one hand and what that can give him, with folly and foolishness and partying and hedonism and everything he can squeeze out of life on the other. And at first he looks at that and he says, there was something there. And then he steps back and he turns to consider more seriously. It's what I was reminded of. I don't know if you've had this experience. I'm sure something like this. It's like this. It seems to me it's like when I'm working on a painting that I'm working on. I had this experience quite frequently. I will work on a painting for a period of time, and all of a sudden, in a period of about an hour and a half or 2 hours, it'll finally come together, and boom, voila, there it is, and I'm just totally stoked. Wow, this is great. I go in the house, sleep on it, come back out into the studio the next day, and I go, no. It's like the second look after you have some distance and some objectivity yields a more objective analysis and conclusion that, in fact, no, it's not there. And it's like that. We all have those experiences where we go through something and the first assessment is, yeah. But then later we realize, no, that really didn't. It had a measure of good stuff in it, but ultimately it didn't work. Now I'm only using that as an analogy because I think he's talking about something much bigger than that. He's talking about comparing his experiences in life where he is a person who is trying to wring from existence everything it has to offer. And given all the toys he had to play with, his first assessment is, wow, oh, lots of toys. Hey, this is cool. Then he steps back and he gives it a deeper consideration. He turns his wisdom on it full on. And he decides that's not the case. He steps back more reflectively and realizes that though there is a measure of satisfaction in all of his achievements and his experiences, that ultimately it fails him in what he truly seeks. It is a vain, they have proven to be vain, proven to be, as he uses the word, futile or full of, by comparison, they're like a vapor compared to what I'm really looking for. They have no substance. It does not provide him with true substantial profit. Now, what is the profit he's looking for? What is the advantage he really wants? What's the measure of comparison? We're getting there. So he's going to give us the big picture, the clue that we need in just a moment. So then in verse 12, "So I turn to consider wisdom, madness, folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done?" I think the drift here is that, I think when he says, "So I turn to consider wisdom, madness, and folly," is basically a repetition of what he says in verse 11. It's the same word, "I turn to consider," turn the same critical evaluation on wisdom, madness, and folly. And I think that's another way of saying, of bracketing all of his experiences from one end of wisdom and knowledge gathering and assessment, critical objective assessment on the one hand, and all that he built clear over to the madness of partying. It's just a way of saying all of it. "I considered it again. For what will a man do who will come after the king except what has already been done?" I think what's going on with this little phrase, this sort of puzzling statement, is that he's sort of reflecting on, here I am the king. I am the greatest ruler that Israel has had. He's the third. But he has already made the statement that his experience is that he is the greatest. He's had it all. There's no one that supersedes him in power, wealth, and wisdom, and having it all. And he's thinking, well, now, I'm the king, and if a king comes after me, wait a minute. What if, is there something that guy might do that I haven't done? Wait a minute. So he's sort of evaluating it from that angle, and he's saying, wait a minute. Can somebody else come in here and sit in my shoes and do more, or think about something that I haven't thought about, or experience something I haven't experienced? And he concludes, no. He's only going to end up doing what I've done. And here again, you get this sense that he's this endless cycle that he starts in chapter 1, where he talks about the clouds and the rain running into the rivers, running out to the sea, and then it vaporizes and goes up and circles around and comes back again. And there's sort of this endless cycle, this repetition. And he uses that as a metaphor to talk about how life, there's nothing new, really. When you really look at it, it's just one generation after another experiencing the same thing. That's his conclusion. So then he says, he goes to verse 13, "And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and yet I know that one fate befalls them both." Okay. He does conclude that after all, wisdom is better than folly or foolishness, as in the same way that being able to see is better than being blind. That is, the light, being in the light and being able to understand things is definitely in this world an experience that is better than being in darkness, than not being able to see and being ignorant. He reflects and concludes that when all things are considered, that wisdom is better than foolishness. And he uses the analogy that wisdom is like having sight as compared to being in darkness and being blind. And then in verse 14, he starts to unpack the clue, the key to the whole thing. In verse 14, which I just read, "The man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and yet I know that one fate befalls them both." Okay, so here he's beginning to unpack what's going on in his thinking and the critical analysis that he's making. The wise man sees how all the efforts and achievements and the fate of man ultimately ends. The wise man is better. He sees that. At least he can see that. The fool is blind and ignorant, and at the mercy of the consequences of his foolishness in this world. It's just a general principle he's making, just a proverbial observation that he's making. And yet, in spite of one being better than the other, that is, wisdom is better than not having wisdom, or foolishness, rather, he realized that they both succumb to death. The wise man and the fool both cannot pass through death. They cannot survive or surmount death. And this is the first mention of the key, I think, to understanding the two different frames that he's talking about. On the one hand, he talks about this world on its own terms. And then the point of comparison is something beyond death, something above death, something that survives death, something that's greater than death, something that can conquer death. So here we have the first key to why he uses this repetition of this life being futile. It's futile with regard to attaining something beyond death. Verse 15, then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. Now here Solomon applies, I think, a ruthless logic, clear-eyed logic. One is wise and is better off in the world. The other is foolish and suffers the consequences in the world. Two different kinds of experience, the wise and the foolish. But both suffer the same ultimate fate. Both will become overcome by death. So this is the one reality that he can't get beyond with everything that he owns, everything that he's done, everything that he is, and all of his greatness. And he asked the question, is one better than the other? Is one really, in the end, given that perspective, given the angle I'm taking on this, is one any better off than the other? They're both dead. They have both succumbed to the tragedy of death. They have both been overcome, and the tone of the book feels this way, by oblivion. My wisdom and insight, Solomon says, into the true realities and the nature of man and his existence in the world has given me insight. My insight has given me an understanding of this world. I see clearly the nature of man and the nature of the world. But my wisdom, the tool, the very wisdom and knowledge that God gave me that is good in this world, is not sufficient. It is, in other words, it's ultimately worthless because it does not provide me with the solution to solve the problem. It does not empower me to overcome death. It enables me to understand where I'm going. It helps me with my analysis. But in and of itself, having wisdom does not solve the problem that my wisdom reveals. I think that's the drift of where he's going. So then in verse 16, for there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die. I think it goes something like this. I have seen that each generation forgets the wise as well as the foolish lessons of history. It will all be forgotten as the future keeps unfolding. That's his observation. He sort of restates the devastating truth. Both the wise and the foolish are stamped out by death. What is there true? Where is the true substantial gain given that reality? Given that fact? So there's kind of this emphasis on, since there's no possibility of a continued existence, in this particular verse, you won't be remembering anything because you're going to be dead. And everyone goes there, and therefore, given the nature of man, it's just one forgetful experience. So then he concludes, "So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futile and striving after wind." He uses in 17 and 18 the word hate. It's as far as I can tell, just a generic, this is the plain Jane word for hate. But in the first case, in verse 17, he says, "I hated life." So one of the things he reflects on and concludes is that the work which has been done under the sun, in other words, all the things I've been looking at and examining, turned into an observation, a grievous observation. A great burden was laid on me once I had critically assessed the true value of everything in light of death. So it's as if he's saying, you know, when I look at my life, I look at being alive, I was overcome by a sense of hating it. I have not been very many times in my life where a place where I had a very strong emotion of wishing I were dead rather than alive. But I have been there a couple of times. And it's no fun. I think he's really sort of opening up his soul and his the reality of what he's experiencing here and telling us that there's a very real sense in which existing, now that I'm seeing what's going on, is worse than not existing. That's the thrust of it. And then he goes on from verse 18. He starts talking about, he uses the same word, "Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor, for which I had labored under the sun." And from verse 18, really, to the end of the chapter, he talks mostly about work, about his labor, his toil, his achievement under the sun. And he uses that word, labor. In verse 18, he says, "All the fruit of my labor, for which I have labored under the sun, I hated all the fruit of my labor, for which I labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me." So he begins to sort of look at, he sort of summed up his picture of existence. Now he turns his focus on the issue of, well, what about my work? What about all this work and labor and hard, the hard, toilsome, difficult achievements that I've pulled off in this life? First of all, he says, not only does death obliterate it all, but the fact is, I'm gone and I have to turn all my work over to someone else. So there's a very real sense in what he's saying is, I'm grieved and burdened, I hate the fact that the so-called advantages that I've built up, the profit that I've built up in this life, is ultimately going to do, I don't take it with me. And in fact, worse than that, I'm going to hand it over to someone else. And death, again, has this great effect, brings this great calamity. And verse 19, "And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have control over all the labor of my life, which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity." So he questions, not only do I end up having to hand it over to someone, I have no certainty of what the character or quality of that man is going to be. I have no guarantee that if I turn something over to somebody else, they're actually going to do something worthwhile with it. And that vexes him. He's troubled by that. There's no way to know that this person will act wisely with the knowledge and the wealth that Solomon passes on. And so he says there in verse 20, "Therefore, I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor, which I had labored under the sun." Here he just comes right out. And there's a sense in which the language here, if I understand it right, he's saying, it's almost the sort of sense of he was looking at it all, and all of a sudden he turned aside from it and crumpled in despair. It's as if despair just completely overwhelmed him when he saw these roadblocks and his dreams sort of fading into vapor in the language that he uses. Verse 21. "When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them, this too is vanity and a great evil. The man who comes after," in other words, I give everything I've earned to this person, everything that made me great, everything that I counted on as being great, as the description of my greatness, to someone who hasn't worked for it, as I have worked for it, inferring that it's very likely, given human nature, I think, reading between the lines, that this person will simply squander it because he has no knowledge or appreciation of what it took to get it. And how often we've seen that just in normal human experience and looking at history. And he says, this too is a great evil. In other words, when I begin to look at all this stuff, when I see how much I have had invested in what I could accomplish in this life and what I could experience in life and what I could truly possess that would be worth possessing to give me ultimately, inferring that I would be fulfilled and satisfied with something in this life, when I look at that, it just turns dark and evil. It's repugnant to him. He's revulsed by it. And it's a reality that lays a grievous burden that weighs him down. And verse 22, he continues this theme of labor, of questioning, what's it worth, everything that I've done? So what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving with which he labors under the sun? In verse 23, because all his days his task is painful and grievous, even at night his mind does not rest. And this too is vanity, it's futile, it's a vapor, it ends up being vain, worthless. In that sense, he's sort of describing or looking at labor as being worthless, futile, bad. In other words, all that work and it's for nothing. So it doesn't gain him anything, and he's seeing all that toil and labor as being essentially worthless. Even to the point where, and he adds the addendum on here, you know how you stay up late at night, or you wake up in the middle of the night and you're thinking about all the things you got to get done and all your dreams and all the things you're going to accomplish and yada, yada. And it turns out that all that itself, when your mind doesn't even rest in your entrepreneurial endeavors, it ends up being silly, futile, useless. Then in verse 24, he says something that almost seems to contradict what he says in 22 and 23. He says, there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. Now he seems to say that labor is okay in the world. Well, if you keep the two frames of reference in mind, it makes sense. On the one hand, he's putting it up against the comparison of ultimate reality and whether something he's doing in this life will ultimately overcome death. Then he's dialing back and looking at just the experience in this world, and he's saying, you know, if you just want to talk about living in the world as we have it, this existence in its true nature, there's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. In other words, to work at what you can do and see that in a certain relative sense, it's good, it's okay. And he says, if that's your experience and if that's your perspective, understand that that is a gift from God. That is a gift. Solomon was gifted with wisdom, remember? And God added all the other stuff along with it. But now he recognizes that anything good in this life is a gift from God, from the hand of God. So eat, drink, work, that's as much as this existence can offer. And given the larger context of ultimate death, you should take this for the qualified goodness that it is as a gift from the hand of God. So take it for what it is. Enjoy it. Be pleased with it. But recognize that it doesn't ultimately add up to what we're ultimately yearning for. God conditions all of our existence. He is the one who writes the story. He starts to unpack, at this point, unpack his perspective on God. Now, he does this through the rest of the book, and we obviously won't get there, but he does begin to reveal his understanding of who God is here, and it's very critical to the rest of the understanding of the book. In verse 25, for who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? Without who? Without God. He understands that if there is anything good in this life, it is because God, the creator and sustainer and the giver of all good things in this life, for what it is, comes from the hand of God. And then in verse 26, for to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he has given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after wind. I think he's just making a general statement here. I haven't reflected a great deal on this verse, but I think what he's saying here just is sort of, again, that sort of proverbial, it's the nature of wisdom literature and Proverbs that you make a generalization. Given who God is, given the nature of reality, given the kind of God that God is, generally speaking, God rewards wisdom and knowledge, and he and those who are good, and he does not reward, he takes away from those that are evil, that are really evil. And then he looks at that and realizes that, again, it all falls under this fabric of, if there isn't anything more than what I've just described, it's all futile. It's all a vapor. It all ultimately disappears. It's insubstantial. So Solomon has outlined his experience. He's outlined the sense of his task and what he's setting about. And he's drawing some conclusions already, right from the very beginning of his book. All of his labor, his wisdom, his sensual, worldly pursuits yield, ultimately for him, nothing. They are futile. They are vain. And here at the end of chapter 2, we see all of that, but we also see a couple of significant beliefs that Solomon holds. Number one, all of reality is ultimately a story that God is writing. God is in control. He is providentially, as one of my friends used to say, God's the boss. He's the creator. We're the creatures. Secondly, all the good things that can be got in this life, and he's just got through saying there are some good things that we can enjoy in this life, are gifts from this God. And then thirdly, there are these two frames of reference. We can talk about the world and what it has to give us, but then we have to set that against the larger picture of what's good in the world, and wisdom and knowledge has a good place in this world. It's a useful thing. But even his wisdom is ultimately useless in the sense, in the end, because it doesn't survive the destruction of death. His wisdom doesn't survive death. It goes with him. Wisdom points out the reality and the profundity of the problem, but it doesn't solve it. It doesn't in itself solve it. Wisdom gives us understanding of our destiny, but we cannot change our destiny. At this point, Solomon has set us up through all this to see that only God the Creator holds the keys to ultimate fulfillment. And ultimate fulfillment is the important adjective, that it is an ultimate fulfillment. And what is that ultimate fulfillment, given what we've been looking at here? The ultimate fulfillment is an existence that conquers death, that is able to transcend death, that can go through death, an existence for which death is not a problem. Now, why this a few comments here as I close, and we'll open it up for a couple of questions. A few closing, concluding thoughts here. About futility, first of all. From Solomon's perspective, we live this reality as if it were able to fulfill us. We actually enter into this world, as he did, through his mind on the one hand, through his folly and the fulfillment of his body pleasures on the other, as if it really could give us what we're ultimately looking for. But it is not. In that sense, it promises, but it doesn't deliver. This world gives, in through its beauty and through some of the good things that are here and some of the sort of, in a sense, glorious experiences that we can have, it sort of points at as if we should be able to be fulfilled from this. Death and destruction await the man after all his labors. But implied in Solomon's despair and his burden is a yearning for a kind of existence that is invulnerable to death. That is, it is invulnerable to death and the destruction of death. The word futility that's used, that transfers the Hebrew word hebel, is translated variously, vain, vapor, futile, and some other things. Interesting, it's also the word that's used in the prophets for the word idol. They refer to idols as hebel because they are useless. But it's futile from, interestingly, I got these little things from Elul in his book, which I'm really looking forward to reading and probably change everything I've said. From the standpoint of reality, this world is insubstantial. That's what it means to be futile. From the standpoint of real reality, our experience in this world is insubstantial. From the standpoint of truth, it is a lie. From the standpoint of efficiency, it is useless. From the standpoint of security, it is a deceit. I'm just going to leak ahead for a second here. In chapter 3, which we're not going to be able to get to, he says of God, I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men which to occupy themselves, and he has made everything appropriate in its time, and he has also set eternity in their heart. Verse 10 and 11. Yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. And we don't have time this morning to unpack that. But basically, I think the problem is that we are, in effect, creatures made. We were created as creatures made for timelessness. But we are bound and imprisoned in time. We have eternity built into us. And we yearn for it and we know it at the deepest levels of our being. But this world, while it may promise something like that, it ultimately fails us. In Romans 8, the New Testament, the great section, that basically this is sort of a microcosm of the whole picture of Ecclesiastes. I'll just read that real quickly. Says, for I consider the sufferings of this time, Paul is writing, verse 18 of chapter 8, are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption, into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. And not only this, but we also ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for the adoption as sons, the redemption of our body. Does the New Testament give us a different picture than Solomon's? In some respects, yes. In glory, in a glorious, amazing sense, yes. In some respects, absolutely not. It is a reflection of where Solomon is in time and in the unfolding of the revelation of God in history, that there are certain amount of knowledge and perspective that he doesn't have that we do have, and that makes a difference. I want to read this last verse, this last passage, though, from 1 Corinthians, because it so summarizes where we are in light of the realities that Solomon is pointing to. In 1 Corinthians 15, verse 50 and following, he says, now I say this, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Solomon is talking about the perishable. He's living the perishable. He yearns for the imperishable. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall be changed. We shall not all die and stay there. We shall be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, for the trumpet will sound and the dead will be raised, imperishable, and we shall be changed. For this perishable must put on the imperishable, and this mortal must put on immortality. But when this perishable will have put on the imperishable, this mortal will have put on immortality, then will come about the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your sting? Where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? I read that this morning and I was just stunned. I think that's what we understand, and Solomon didn't understand how that was going to work out. I think there's lots of evidence in the book that he definitely understood God rightly, and he understood himself rightly, and that he's bracketing, in a sense, this is the most profound little body of writing about the existential reality that we all face, and the big issues that we come to terms with. There's not much time, but a few comments, a question or two.
At the beginning, you mentioned his perspective was based on personality and experience.
On?
Personality.
Oh.
On Solomon's personality.
I sort of.
You brushed over it really quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, one, what you feel Solomon's personality was, or the strong traits in his personality that would have drawn him to write the way he did, and two, if somebody didn't have whatever personality traits you mentioned, and it was written from a different perspective, how you feel that would have changed the tone of the book, or how that perspective would have changed. I mean, I don't think the truth would have changed it in the statement, but I'm just curious.
Well, I'm sort of just going on just reading the book and rereading it, looking at it, and sensing the tone of the whole thing, and thinking that he may have inherited, you know, I think David gives some evidence of being a really high in the sky one moment and in the pits the next. So a sort of melancholy type of personality, fluctuating personality. And so it wouldn't make sense that in some respects Solomon may be a little steadier, but maybe also a little more prone to depression. Maybe. I'm only speculating at this point, but I'm guessing. There isn't any clear evidence of that here. I mean, I think this could have been written by somebody who wasn't necessarily prone to that side of things. I'm guessing. But it wouldn't surprise me if that were the case. And you have to remember that Solomon started off with good evidence here in the scriptures, that Solomon started off being someone who inherited from his father an understanding of God that was accurate and true, and that he loved God. In humility, he seems to have a real fervor and vital relationship with God, in that sense of wanting to please God and know God in a true way. Yet then he goes through, as is true in the history in Chronicles and Kings, he goes through a period where he explores options and things that he can do that are definitely destructive and a waste and dissipation and basically sin, and you know, to the point of letting idolatrous wives come and build idols in and around Jerusalem. So my working theory at this point is that if his personality was that way, and if, as a very thoughtful, reflective man, as well as someone who engaged fully in what he describes himself as having engaged in, the hedonism and the exploitation of everything he could get out of life, if at the end he looks back, he's come to his senses, he's gone through some experiences that have, through which he's incurred some damage. I think we can damage ourselves. I have experienced some of that. The glory and mercy of God is that he takes the damage and uses it as grist for the mill. And we actually gain spiritually by going through the hard time. God actually, in a sense, transcendently works through all that in a way that only God could do that to to use the very rebellion and evil that's in us to be the means by which he saves us and brings us to our senses. If that's true, then Solomon might be someone who went through that. The damage was there, but now he looked back with the effects of the in his body and mind of those things, but he still has the clarity to see what's really true. And he believes it. That's about as far as I could go. Just about, I think just maybe one more question here, then we're going to have to...
Thanks, Wes. I really appreciate what you're saying. And the other day, you and I were joking about how, you know, one thing Solomon didn't say is, you know, he was never in a rock band. So how could
yeah,
he really
could he,
know?
How could he say anything? I mean, if he wasn't in a rock band, then...
But I think that we, as human beings, we're always wanting to hold out for that. You know, there is something out there that's going to fulfill us in this life. I mean, it's just that human tendency to really grasp for things here. And I think that that same temptation is there for the Christian as well as the non-Christian. I mean, I you know, we maybe the believer starts to get a little bit of wisdom and can work at resisting that temptation a little bit, but it's still very much there. And I think that there's a temptation for Christians to look at Solomon and say, the reason why this book is so good for us, so, you know, the wisdom that you get is that this is what happens when you're not a believer. Mm. This is as far as you can get. But now that we've got, you know, Jesus, now that we've got the power of the Holy Spirit, we do, you know, not all is vanity. We do have things that we can experience or whatever in this life, and maybe we tend to take that kingdom to come, that salvation, that overcoming death as kind of the given, and we put that in our back pocket, and then we get on with our Christian activities, our ministry or whatever. I just thought maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well put. I've experienced that. I know of a believer. I mean, it's a struggle. What we believe gets, by the mercy of God, clearer and clearer, and our understanding gets clearer and clearer, but there are still those crisis moments where choices are made that where we may not make the right decision. But again, the mercy and grace of God is such that he ends up using all that stuff in a way that only he can to bring us to clear, true understanding of life. Quick prayer. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the truth. I pray that you will break our hearts, that we want to know it. And we need each other to encourage and nurture and remind each other of how desperately we need only what you have. Thank you for the gift of Christ. Amen.